listener production.
The creators of this podcast would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which it is recorded. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the first storytellers of this land. We pay respect to their elders, past, present and emerging, as well as any Indigenous people who may be listening today.
Everyone Relax, this is Will Anderson and this is Topop with Friends. And today's friend is Joel Kimbusa. Joel Kimbusa is very funny and is going to be at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival doing a show with another person that I think is very funny, Zainab Johnson. If you don't know who Joel is, well, I mean, in a way you've come to the right place because this is what a podcast is. We're going to have a chat and then at the end of it, you'll hopefully know more about him. I'm so sorry. I'm tired. It's been a big, very, very big month for me and today is my first kind of day off and my recording equipment just carked it, so I'm doing this introduction into my phone in the hope that I can give my shows a plug that start at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival very soon. It's called Will Legitimate. Thank you to everyone who's come out in Adelaide and Canberra to see the show so far. Melbourne is next, Sydney, Brisbane, Perth, and a whole bunch of other places, comedy.com.au. I think you're going to love the show, so please come along, and I would love to see you there. So Joel Kimbusa is today's guest. I'm not good at doing this intro today. You can check out all our other podcasts in the Everyone Relax feed. Our AFL adjacent podcast, Two Guys, One Cup, is back. Topop is there. Willosophy is there. It's all good. All good times. I've got broken equipment. I'm doing this intro into my phone. Everything's fine in the world. I'm going to stop talking now. Enjoy this episode. Okay, so you come into Melbourne. You've been in Melbourne before, though, right, for the comedy festival?
Yeah, this is my like third or fourth time. It's hard to know. The pandemic really fucked me up. I just can't recall anything pre-2019 anymore. But yeah, I think this is third or fourth time coming to Melbourne.
Okay, so I'm interested in the pre-2019 because there's this there's a real thing, right? Like there's some sort of time dysplasia that they say that people now have because all the key markers of that we measure time by, those anniversaries that we have each year, the reason that high schools have graduations is that you can kind of remember a time and place where you were, what you were doing, what music was playing. And then suddenly we've got this like gray wash of like three or four years, and now you're just like, if I was in the movie I Know What You Did Last Summer, I'd be like, great, what did I do last summer?
Yeah, please tell me. Yeah, remind me.
I murdered.
I have a very firm belief that lockdown year did not count, so I actually don't think we should own, like, if you turn, we shouldn't count birthdays that happened during lockdown. So we should all just skip over that part. And so I'm not actually 36, I'm 35, because we are not recognizing the year that I spent in my house. I think we all owe it to ourselves.
I like this, but could we extend it just in a different way that everyone gets? Because I think that the pandemic and the lockdowns and the global, it was different in different places and in different ways, right? Everybody experienced.
For sure, yeah.
But there was definitely, everybody had something in their life that was fucked up by the experience of it. So maybe you just get one thing that you can nominate. And for you, I'm happy for it to be your birthday. You can have your, that's yours if you want to lock it in. But for somebody else, it might just be that argument they had with somebody at the supermarket when they were really stressed about toilet paper. And they're just, I want to take that one back. That's the one that I don't want.
For sure. Full weddings, I think that's fair game too, yeah. The amount of Zoom weddings I went to,
Now, these Zoom weddings, were these people who were previously in relationships or were these people who met online during the pandemic and then decided to get on?
No, all of them were people that had been in relationships prior to the pandemic. I genuinely don't quite understand what the rush was. Like, I feel like, I don't know, none of these people, I don't know, maybe it was a health insurance thing for some of them. I genuinely don't know.
It probably was.
That's the only reason I could think of is if you needed to get on your partner's health insurance, and you need to be married to do that. That's the only reason why I would have my wedding during a lockdown.
We're here today, gathered for the noblest of all reasons: paperwork.
Yeah, exactly. You guys, I don't know exactly what the healthcare situation is in Australia. Is it? Do you guys have socialized medicine in Australia?
I mean, look, it has its limitations, like anywhere that attempts socialized
for
medicine.
Sure. But you people aren't going bankrupt going into medical debt in Australia.
No, that's that is absolutely correct. In fact, when I was living in the States and I was touring, I used to say to people, and I was serious when I said this, I said, if I break my arm or my leg or I'm like sick in any way, like you do not put me in an ambulance. You take me straight to the airport. You put me on a plane to Australia and then I will go to a nice Australian hospital where they will pay for everything.
Yeah, no, it is. It's like so sad. I know this is a comedy podcast, but I work with a lot of homeless people in LA via a nonprofit here. And it is like the people that you talk to, the number of people that are on the streets in the US because one surprise medical bill sort of ruined them, like it just set off a chain reaction to the point that they lost everything, it's insane. And like I hear that from people in the UK and other countries that have socialized healthcare, and they're like, yeah, it's not always the best though, like I'm sure the care is better in the US, but the fact is that like the care in the US for someone without health insurance is way worse and practically non-existent for someone who is living under you know, the NHS or something like that. So I think like there's obviously going to be trade-offs, but I would much rather be unexpectedly injured in Australia than I would be here. Welcome to the comedy podcast, by the way.
That's the good headline of the podcast, that you're happy to be unexpectedly injured in Australia. So come along to a show. Nose is well covered in this country. Everything's going to be fine. If you're going to have an accident, have it here. But I think you're right. Now, I mean, you know what? It's a comedy podcast, but it doesn't have to be all comedy. It's fine. We can talk about the world. And I think this is like absolutely what you're saying is, because if the pandemic taught us anything, that it is illness does not discriminate. Like you can, anyone can get sick, right? So this idea that you are just constantly living in this situation, particularly in America where so much of your health insurance is connected to your employment, right?
Like, right. And that's the crazy thing. I always say I probably would have been way more successful as a stand-up way sooner if I wasn't chained to my very stressful 50-hour-a-week day job that I had to have because I had to have health insurance because I have a lot of pre-existing conditions that require medical care. And so I was working at startups when I was like, I would work 10 to 6 and then 7 to midnight, I would be doing open mics in New York at night. And I knew so many comics that were like, you know, working half that amount of time because they didn't need health insurance or were on their parents' health insurance still, or like came from money, or just like didn't need to have a high stress day job in order to have health insurance. And so I'm constantly bitter because I'm like, yeah, I would have broken in my 20s way sooner if I could have just gotten by dog walking and really been able to like focus and not been exhausted every single time I went on stage.
Do you feel like now though that you like, I mean, that your career, like, you know, very much is established and, you know, you're traveling the world doing comedy and you're this person who's having all these opportunities. Is it okay that it took a little bit longer? Because I feel like you have this calmness about you now, or this attitude about you, this kind of control around what it is that you're doing on your in your comedy, even when it's like, you know, even when, you know, you're being like expressive or like, comedically flamboyant around an idea or whatever, there's this real sense of calmness and control at the heart of what you do. I think that, was that always there, or is that a thing that's come a little bit more?
Oh, no, you know what? I appreciate you saying that. It's easy to play the woulda, coulda, shoulda game, but I am generally pretty glad that it happened the way that it did. I think that, like, I wouldn't change necessarily any of the decisions that I made leading up to this, because it all got me to where I am now, which is far and away beyond what I ever could have hoped for myself or dreamt for myself back in my 20s. I think there's like, and I think like, again, you're right. Like, I think it all happened at a moment when I was able to handle it. Like, because I think like, I'm the same age as Lena Dunham, and I remember when I was 24, living in Chicago at the time, when she broke, and with Girls, I just remember thinking, like, what the fuck? Like, this girl is the same age as me, and she's, you know, writing, directing, starring, producing in this hugely successful, really wonderful show. And I just remember being like, what am I doing with my life? Like, I am so behind, you know, like I had basically just started doing stand up like maybe a year or two before that. And I was still in Chicago. But I will say this, like, it did sort of kick me in the ass. Like, I did sort of accelerate moving to New York to do stand up as like my primary thing, because I was so scared about like being on the same page as Lena Dunham, which is wild. But again, like, I'm really glad that it all worked out, because I don't think I could have handled the amount of pressure that she was up against at the time, for a myriad of reasons, some warranted and some unwarranted, at 24 at all. Like, I'm really glad that it all happened when it did. Now, that being said, like, it has made this period of my career really high stress, and really I put a lot of pressure on myself, because I do feel there is sort of like a countdown clock that I'm up against now, in a way that I wouldn't have been had I been doing what I'm doing now 10 years ago. I only have so much time left.
Tell me about
play.
That. Like, how much time do you have? Like, what is this countdown clock? What do you think you're running out of time to do?
I'm getting fucking old, man. And like, I'm lucky that I look like this, and that I have the genes that I do, so that I can still roughly play late 20s. Like, it was actually funny. I just had a birthday, and my theatrical agent, was wishing me a happy birthday. And he was like, oh, how old are you turning? And I was like, shouldn't you know that? And he was like, oh no, to me, you're 27 to 32. That's all I need to know is that age range. But yeah, no, I'm feeling it, because I am at this awkward stage. There's not a lot of parts that, like, I don't know, like, I'm too young to be a dad, but I'm too old to be like late 20s in a lot of scenarios. It depends on like what the situation is. I mean, let's be honest, if Riverdale was still on, I could be a college sophomore and it would be believable because all those people were in their 30s in high school. But yeah, I do feel this sense of like, I only have so much time to, and it's all, and I know that's not true, because I see it, you know, you see so many examples of people breaking in their 40s or their 50s even. You know, Leslie Jones didn't get SNL until she was almost 50, you know, and that's when she really popped off. And so I have plenty of time, I'm doing well, but like, I just feel the existential dread of turning older.
Okay, so what is it that you want to actually, because you've already done so much stuff. Like, this was,
yeah.
I first, you know, started seeing you pop up online, and then I was like, oh, you're very funny. And I was like, saw that you were coming out to the Melbourne Comedy Festival and started following everything that you were doing. I watched, forgive me, I should have done, like, if I feel like I know the person, I make the mistake of never going back and then, like, actually checking things on Wikipedia to make sure that what I'm about to say is not wrong. Was the movie called Fire Island? Is that what it was called?
Yes, yeah.
Yes, it was so funny and so just and sweet and like just, but also just something a bit unlike anything that I had seen. So you obviously have these ambitions to be, you know, like Lena Dunham-esque, in the idea of you're not just here to act or do stand up or whatever. You want to like create and produce and, you know, put together ensembles and like, so what is it that, like, I mean, if, take aside what age group you could play in something, what are these key things that are inside you that you want to get out to the world?
No, I mean, I want to, I think like Lena, Issa Rae, like Phoebe Waller-Bridge, like these people are people that I've really looked up to and as sort of multi-hyphenate creators. And I want to have an empire. Like I don't want to Fire Island is a really good distillation of all of the things that I want to accomplish. Like I want to wear all those hats. I want to produce, I want to write, I want to act still. I want to be able to, you know, create good work. And I want, you know, I would love to have a production company of my own someday and produce other people's work and like really figure out a way to uplift and elevate people, that, you know, you know, people took a chance on me, and I want to take similar chances on people that, you know, don't come from backgrounds or situations that maybe set them up for a huge amount of success in this industry, you know, like people who really had to work to get to where they are. And granted, that could all happen in my 40s. That could all happen in my 50s. But I, you know, I want it to happen while I'm young and hot, I guess.
Well, we finally got there. We got to the heart of it. Yes. Well, you can still advantage. I mean, there's no point becoming like an old aged wizened celebrity who can't take advantage of the fame that you've been offered. You need a little, you know, good fun times in between. So,
exactly.
You know what I'm fascinated by? I once read somewhere that you had started doing stand-up. You actually started by opening for theatre plays. Is that true? Or is that like a myth around you? Or is that actually how it happened?
No. So, I mean, what happened was is I studied theatre in college and I moved to Chicago because it has an incredible theatre scene close to where I grew up, felt very safe. And I was doing a lot of theatre in Chicago, storefront theatre, like really, you know, like guerrilla, like... low-tech, like low-budget theater in Chicago, which I loved. And I was really keyed into that community in the first year that I was in Chicago. And it was at the end of the first year that I was in Chicago after college that I started doing stand-up. And it was because, I don't know if you're familiar with the comedian Beth Stelling. Incredible. Yeah, incredible comedian. We were working on a play together. And it was the... I went to go see her at this show, legendary Chicago comedy show called Entertaining Julia. It was like the Sunday night weekly show. Like Robin Williams would drop in, you know, like if any big name was in town, they would drop in. And it was this tiny, tiny bar show. Like, you know, probably could fit less than 100 people in the room. And I went and saw her in this show. And it was the first time that I'd seen stand up and felt like, oh, this is what stand up is. Uh-huh. Because like, I think like when I was in high school, the biggest like comic was Dane Cook, and no disrespect to Dane Cook, who I do think is very funny, did make me laugh when I was in high school, but nothing about Dane Cook's stand-up made me think like, oh, this is for me, or like this is something I could do. It just felt like it was in a, you know, in a completely different sort of world than what was available to me. And seeing Beth for the first time was the first time that I was like, oh, like people like me with voices similar to mine are doing this as well. And she was the one who first told me like, hey, like I was really frustrated with the acting roles that I was auditioning for at the time. I was feeling really limited. You know, this was, you know, over a decade ago. So it was much before we were having this sort of talks about diversity and casting that we are now. And so I felt very limited. And she was like, you're a writer, you're a performer, you should just try doing stand-up. And so I started doing it. The first time I ever did it was actually at a variety show that my theater company was holding. And it was like a mixed bag of like music and improv and sketch. And then they were like, we have a slot open. Do you want to do something? It can be whatever you want, just 5 minutes of whatever you want. And I was like, I guess I'll do stand up. I'll try stand up for the first time. And I did it that night. And it was a packed, sold out crowd and I crushed. And I think like that really changed the course of my life, because had I done poorly, I don't think I would have tried to do it again. I think I would have hung up my hat after that if it had gone poorly. And make no mistake, I bombed many, many, many times in that first year of doing stand-up and since. But that first taste of doing really well, it really changed how I looked at like sort of what path I wanted to take. And the reason I was doing so much like opening for plays at Steppenwolf and stuff like that was because I wasn't super keyed into the stand-up community in Chicago, because I invested so much energy in the theater community in Chicago that like it was really hard for me to remove myself from that community and dive starting at zero into another artistic community in Chicago. And so I really leveraged my connections in the theater community to make sort of couple together a sort of makeshift stand-up career in Chicago. And so like it was interesting, like I would do plenty of regular quote-unquote stand-up shows, but like none of those comics knew me. Nobody in the comedy scene really had like a super close relationship to me. I would always sort of breeze in and like be the new person on the lineup that no one had ever seen before, and most of the time do pretty well. But like I wasn't super well respected in the community because I don't think people perceived me as grinding very hard as a stand-up. Like I think people, didn't see me at enough open mics, didn't see me, you know, like doing enough of the club shows and blah, 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 all these things. And I remember part of the reason I moved to New York, quote unquote, too soon, I was told by many comics in Chicago that I was moving to New York way too early in my career, that I hadn't done, you know, XYZ show in Chicago yet. I hadn't done the reps and it was too early. I would get swallowed up by New York. But part of that decision for me was like, okay, I actually want to stop focusing on theater and acting and writing and really just focus on stand up full time. And it was just too difficult for me to do that, to start over in Chicago, because it was too easy for me to do these like little slots opening for plays and things like that. And so part of my decision, the calculus of me moving to New York, was like, okay, if I'm really going to do this, I'm going to do this and I'm going to dive in and I'm going to make it my full time focus as much as I could outside of my job. And the thing is like I moved at the same time to New York from Chicago with some of the biggest Chicago heavy hitters in comedy that had been, you know, the mayors and like leaders in the Chicago comedy community. We all moved at the same time. But the thing is that they don't really talk about is no one gives a shit what you did in Chicago or for how many years you did it in Chicago when you moved to a city like New York. They don't care. You start from zero no matter what. And so for me, I was finally going to open mics, multiple open mics a night, waiting until the end, waiting 2 hours to do 2 minutes of material, which was, for me, not that big of an adjustment because that's my life. That was my life in Chicago. But for all of those other comics that I'd moved with who'd been doing it for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, it was a real ego blow for them. It was a much more difficult transition for them than it was for me because they had waited quite a long time to do it, to start over from zero. And so they were much farther from zero than I was when I moved to New York. And so we sort of, at that point, sort of started really rising at the same rate once we moved to New York because no one knew who we were. And yeah, and so the first like many years in New York, I would say the first almost 4 years in New York, I really didn't do anything but stand up. I wasn't acting. I wasn't going out for acting jobs. I wasn't writing. I was writing a lot on the side, you know. I was still sort of. I wrote a few plays.
Can I ask about what you were, what you were writing? Because like when you've come from outside that stand up world, and by the way, I love voices that come from outside that traditional "you've got to do it this way" thing, because every scene has this dumb set of rules because comedy doesn't actually have any rules about how it all works.
Exactly.
Yeah. People want to make up some so that like everybody needs their, you know, 12 rules for life or their 10 commandments or their something that they can just, their secret or whatever it is that they go, this is the way that you're meant to be doing things, even though it's been proved time and time again, it's not the way that you're meant to be doing things. But it's also how fresh ideas come in, because if you haven't been raised watching comedy, so much of people who've loved comedy, and I was actually one of those people who loved comedy, you come into comedy and you're kind of already like, you know, singing the same songs, you know, using the same chords as the people who came before you. Whereas people who come in from the sides, from other areas that weren't raised on stand-up comedy, sometimes just have a different way of doing it or a different perspective that makes it all a bit more interesting and glorious. So when you started out in New York, what was your approach?
I mean, it was a fucking shotgun. I was just throwing as much shit at the wall as I possibly could every single night, going up as many times as possible and really learning. I think I had a fair amount of like natural like talent and charisma as a performer. I think I didn't really learn how to write a joke, a tight joke, until I moved to New York and was really surrounded by some of the best comics in the country, quite frankly. Like I there is no better city to do stand up in the US than New York. I think Chicago is an incredible incubator. I think there are many great incubator cities like San Francisco and Portland in the US that are great places to start, but New York is where I think most people get good. I really do. And I think like part of that is that I was finally doing these open mics where I would literally wait sometimes like upwards of an hour to do 90 seconds of stage time. Like that's how competitive it was when I moved to New York and how, you know, how the open mic scene worked there for a lot of the time. And when you have 90 seconds to be on stage versus 5 minutes or 10 minutes, you really learn about economy of words. You really learn how to get to the punchline and how to edit and how to like get to the funny part faster. And there is this like there is a real stylistic difference between people who came up in LA and people who came up in New York. And the fact of the matter is that you get less stage time in LA. It's not feasible to do as many spots in LA because it's too spread out. You have to drive, you have to find parking, all of these things. And there's just less of it in general. And also a lot of the open mics in LA, you get 5 minutes to get up there and sort of hem and haw and like tell your meandering story. And there are many innumerable amount of funny comics who started in LA and they figured it out and they have their very specific style. But I do think that if you look at comics who come up in New York versus LA, there is just so much more fluff in an LA comics set sometimes, or at least the ones who started who haven't sort of, you know, there's a lot more chat in an LA comic set than there is in a New York comic set. And I will say now, having been in LA since 2019, having not gone up as much, I have sort of reverted into I've fallen back on a lot of chat, because you just have a more luxurious amount of time to like get to your joke than you do when you start in New York.
Also, I do think there is something to be said about the fact that when you have the time, that like there is something nice about then taking some of the time.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
Like, you know, I think that is actually the appropriate artistic response. It'd be weird to take that 90-second, 5-minute New York energy to, you know, 60 minutes, 70 minutes when you have that like pace and time. And do you notice when you come to somewhere like Melbourne, because obviously Melbourne in particular, like it's a festival city when it comes to comedy. Comedy happens there all year round, of course. It's a big comedy city, but it identifies so much with that huge festival that they have. And so much of the comedy is, you know, festival style comedy, big, you know, one person show style comedy, but not just that, you know, like all sorts of, but you know, it doesn't necessarily have that New York type rhythm. What happens when you come to a place like Australia or Melbourne to do comedy?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I do find sometimes, I remember especially in my first year when I was still living in New York and still like really in that mode, it was just like machine gun, like punchline. And there is an element to it of like, oh, they aren't used to this. You have to slow it down a little bit. Like they are used to... there's just a different pace, I think. And that's not, and it's not, it's like a very subtle change, I think. Like comics probably recognize it more than audiences do. But it is a change. And I think that the fact of the matter is that the way stand-up works in Australia and the UK and places that do sort of like where people write new hours every single year, that's crazy to me. That is the craziest difference in how stand-up works in the US versus how stand-up works in Australia and the UK, because it took me, I would say, probably upwards of 6 years to write the material that went into my Netflix special, you know, like to really hone that material. And like, you know, you build it up and like it, I will work on 5 minutes of material for months before I feel like it's ready to like be put into the hour that I'm doing in my headlining show, you know, and like, the mindset is just so different because like you do have to like you're suddenly writing a new hour of material every year. Like that's crazy to me. And I will say it results in a lot of shows, and this is no shade to anybody in particular because I respect what UK comics and Australia comics do to create those hours, but it creates a lot of shows that are really strong half hours but not completely tight hour shows.
I say this as someone who's done a yearly show nearly every year for the last 30 years, that really they should make it compulsory that it's at every second year, really. It's like, you know, like there's rarely anyone. Well, and I say this as
well,
someone.
And this is another reason why so many UK comics and Australian comics come to the US, move to the US, and suddenly have this bank of a fucking plus material that they can pull from because they have 6 hours of material to choose from when they start over from zero in the US, and they can just pick and choose all of the best bits from all of their hours that they've written for festivals over the course of the years. And they are astounding when they move to the US because I'm just like, what is this? What is this tight 15 minute set that is all fucking hits after hits? Because it is like, it's just a different approach. And I will say I'm so grateful for my time at the Melbourne Comedy Festival, because being exposed to those different styles of writing stand-up and presenting stand-up in a more one-man show sort of style sometimes, it really did. It is what locked into place what became my Netflix special. Because the first, I would say when I first started trying to sell the hour that I, that is roughly the same as my Netflix special, people did not bite. And then when I really, because it was just an hour of really strong jokes, which is like great, you know, like that's what a stand-up special ultimately should be. But when I looked at the material and looked at the hour and said like, okay, but how can I structure this so that it feels like there's a real beginning, middle, end? Like it was bringing, it actually brought me back to my theater training where I was like, what is the three act structure of this hour? Like, how can I arrange this material in a way so that it thematically has a quote unquote point? Mm-hmm. Mission statement almost, and how can I arrange it so that there's almost like a theatrical flow to the way the material is presented? And that is when people really wanted to buy the special, was when it felt like a complete thought, like it felt like it was doing, like it felt like an hour of not just randomly assorted jokes, but like something that was building to, I hesitate to use the word message because that really gives me the ick, but like a point, like a, like I had a thesis basically for the hour that ended up bringing all that material together.
I think there is a point, and I think you're right that the point does elevate it, by the way. I think that it doesn't, there's nothing icky about it at all. I think it's the thing that separates it from something that would be, yes, a great hour of stand-up comedy jokes, but there is something about that. I'm very interested in what you think the point is going into it, and is that the message that people have got from it? Like, how well did what you were trying to do translate to what the audience have got from it?
I think it has and it hasn't. I think, like, so the point for me, like, it was really this, like, approaching, like, stand-up as a representational figure, you know? Like, since I broke as a stand-up comedian, I have been heralded as a representative of the gay community and as the Asian community, and that's, like, a double-edged sword because I think, you know, I talk about it in the set, like, it's an honor to be one of the early, you know, people who've broken, who have met my sort of demographic checkboxes, but it's also, like, really frustrating when I just want to tell a joke sometimes, and it's has to be seen through this lens of like, what is this saying about Asian people? What is this saying about gay people? And that is never, and like, I can tell you, I think almost all of us who are coming from a minority POV and stand up do not want to get painted into that corner of like, you are representing a group of people and that's all you are doing with your set. And so like, singling out the straight white guy in the set and sort of returning to him and sort of asking him those questions of like, do you relate to this? Like, you know, am I representing the community well or not? Like, having fun with that idea was sort of the point of like taking it out and like examining the idea of being a representative, what that means. Am I good at it? Am I bad at it? Does it sort of box me out from, you know, being able to relate to straight white men who are the primary consumer of stand-up, or so we're told? And yeah, and so honestly, like, it was really interesting because, you know, like when Hannah Gatsby first released Nanette, over in the US especially, I think, like, because I saw it at a festival and I was wowed. But this was after I had been to festivals and saw what a lot of festival shows are like. And I think a lot of American consumers of stand-up reacted to Nanette as like, what is this? What is this trauma? Like, why is she talking about trauma? Why is she including trauma in, or why are they including trauma in the set? And I was like, oh, this is just a festival show. Like, you don't, I don't think American audiences are used to that mix of the serious and the thematic and the thesis-y sort of stand-up. They are used to just like rapid fire, this is an hour of jokes with no real point. And so when that dust up was happening in the US and like people were sort of like debating on whether or not it was a stand-up or a what out, I was like, no, this is just the style of stand-up from where Hannah is from. And it's like very, it was like so I'm so glad that I saw it after having spent time at festivals, because I was able to appreciate it on that level without having it, without like necessarily needing it to be the most joke dense special that I'd ever seen.
Yeah, that was the funny reaction, wasn't it? Because I think that, like, for people who've been to festivals, you're like, yeah, this has the style and shape of a festival show. This is an exceptional version of one of them. Like, you know, this is like a real, this is like a really good version of what a festival show is like, but it is a version of what a festival show is like. This isn't a recognizable form to people or anything like that. And I also enjoyed, in your slight correction of the pronouns there when you were telling that story, you would, it was the person who was complaining, and I'm not sure the person who was complaining would have been
right. No, exactly. But yeah, it's just different. And I think especially coming from a theater background, I think the stand-up tradition in Australia and the UK, especially the UK, is so much more connected to theater than it is in the US. Like I think a lot of people see theater and stand-up like as like very diametrically opposed in the US, and I think that is doing a I think people are not giving enough credit to theater, and I think that and also not enough credit to stand-up and what stand-up can be. But I'm really grateful that I was able to experience it, because it taught me how to incorporate, like, I remember moving to New York and being like, I need to completely bisect these two parts of my performance upbringing and writing upbringing, and be like, no, I'm not doing theater anymore. It must be stand up. I'm glad that I went to a festival and sort of saw how that those two things could be combined in a really effective way.
I mean, particularly for someone like you, where it's like quite incredible, because you have those New York stand-up chops, right? Like, so you have that joke dance, you know, here I am. I was raised on like the mean streets of New York stand-up, where you have to get to the point as quickly as possible. And like, you know, the audience are going to make you accountable and you can't ramble on. But you have this background that is theatrical and acting and directing and imagining whole projects, and this, like, I'm not as successful as Lena Dunham and I should be creating universes. And like, it's so... For someone who has those skills that you have, it's so weird to try to separate them out and not say, hang on, this stand-up thing that I do would be much improved by taking some of these elements of, you know, everything else that I do into it. You know, the theatricality, the storytelling, the context, the point of view, the theatrical device of using someone in the audience. Like, these are all, you know, things that, you know, you have these skills. You haven't had to learn how to do these things extra. It's just about incorporating that full you into the performance. I think that's why the Netflix special feels so, satisfying, I think is the word that I would use. Like, it feels like it has a real sense of, oh, yeah, okay, this is like, you know, some of this point of view, of course, I've heard before, but I'm hearing it expressed in a very unique and honest, and it feels like, you know, a bit more fully formed way. And I just found it really so much fun to watch. Have you felt like more of that has leaked in? It becomes a bit more of a richer, more satisfying performance?
I think it's so interesting now to see this new generation of queer and otherwise, let's just say, oppressed voices, like, doing stand-up, because I feel like I really, for me anyways, on a personal level, like, I, with my last special, with Psychosexual, I really, like, put to bed a lot of what I had to say about it, you know? Like, I think people who came up in my generation who are gay or queer or minorities in any sort of way felt like really, like, we had to, for some of us anyways, like, address it and, like, talk about it, because it did affect sort of my point of view and my life and in interesting ways. But now I see so many young queer comics coming up who don't feel like they have to address it, don't feel like they have to be a spokesperson for the community, don't feel like they have to address, like, gay people are like this and straight people are like this. You know, it still happens. But and that's really freed me up. I'm at a really interesting crossroads right now as a stand-up, as I'm working on this new hour, you know, towards my next special possibly, is like, what is it? What am I? Who am I now? Like, I have like 10 minutes on being 5'9" and like what it, the experience of being short versus tall, you know? And it's like so freeing, because like I finally feel like I can just, like, I'm not so preoccupied with, you know, how my experience is different, because now I am coming at it from a much more privileged sort of perspective as a comic who's been doing this for 14 years and has a Netflix special and like doesn't, and people know that, you know, like they've heard me talk about it enough. And so now I can just be silly and like a little bit more random with the kind of stuff I want to talk about.
I mean, that's incredible. It's incredible to like free you up. And it did feel like that. It felt like, here's what I have to say about this. And now it is said. And it does feel generational. Like, you know, I've seen it in my years in comedy of people come through the initial, like whether they be, you know, a gay person, a person of color, whatever it might be, they lean on the stereotypes of that thing. That's how audiences get integrated. But there comes a generation that don't lean on the stereotypes. They subvert the stereotypes. And then there comes a generation that doesn't need to talk about it at all because it's been talked about and they can just talk about whatever it is that they want to on stage to be funny about. And that can be that if they want to, but it doesn't have to be anymore. It can be, I'm 5'9" and here is my 5-minute joke about that. And I think that's exciting.
I think it speaks volumes about the way that the demographics for stand-up audiences have changed too. Because, you know, when I was coming up and I was like first starting to headline clubs and no one knew who the fuck I was, and I was performing for, I would say, 80 to 90% straight white audiences, and like it, they won't let you like they won't let go of it. You know, like I stand up, I step out on stage. I'm clearly not white. I am, by most people's estimations, pretty clearly gay, and so like you sort of, I think like for a lot of those audiences, when I was performing in like fucking Wilmington, North Carolina, they were like, okay, you have to address this. Like, what's the elephant in the room here? Like, you are not like us. And I think what's freeing up a lot of the new generation of comics is the audiences have diversified incredibly. And I also think that there's just like pockets now where like there was an immense amount of pressure on me when I was in New York to be like, don't just stay in Brooklyn. Don't just stay in the alt rooms. Don't just do the queer rooms. Like, you have to make sure that you can play in front of a club audience and an alt audience, a Brooklyn audience and a Manhattan audience. And I don't think that they feel that pressure anymore. I really don't. Like, I know plenty of really stellar, fantastic, talented comics who have no interest in doing the club scene at all. And they no longer have to. They just don't. You know, like, there's just so many other ways to make money doing this and to break in doing this now that they don't, they can go and just perform predominantly in front of audiences that look and are like them. And that is another reason why they don't feel they need to address all of the ins and outs of their identity anymore, I think, because they're performing to an audience that's on equal footing to them, that doesn't need to be explained all the ins and outs of what it's like to be gay and Asian, you know? And I think that's great. I really do. Like, you know, there's still a bunch of comics who can do all rooms, and I think that's a skill unto itself. But like, I think that the fact that there is so much of an audience now for comedy in a way that didn't exist 10 years ago, that it's just great. It really is.
People should watch your Netflix special. They should watch Fire Island. It's honestly one of those things that is just such an unexpected delight. You know, like it's one of those things that I just think there will be people listening to this who've never seen it, who will watch it and just go, oh, wow. And I don't even want to say too much about it because, like, I think it's one of those things that I went into it very blind of knowing what it was that I was walking into. And I think part of what made it so spectacular was not knowing, you know, so I don't want to give too much away other than to say I think people would very much enjoy that, and I highly recommend people check it out. But tell me about Melbourne. What are you bringing to Melbourne? Are you doing more of Australia? Are you doing other dates or just Melbourne when you're in Australia?
Just Melbourne this time. I usually, you know, while I'm over there, try to hit up as many other places as I can, Sydney, what have you, because it's, you know, it's a chore to get over there. But this time I don't have the bandwidth or the time, so I'm just hitting up Melbourne, which is honestly fine for me because Melbourne, the festival audiences in Melbourne, quite frankly, are some of the smartest comedy audiences that you'll get to perform for, I think, worldwide. Just because Melbourne audiences, the average Melbourne comedy festival attendee, I think is just so well-versed in comedy. They've seen so much comedy. They are not 101 students in comedy. Like, they've heard all of the first thought versions of a joke, you know? They just have. And so you have to be a little smarter. You have to be a little farther. It's really hard to be ahead of an audience that is that smart and that comedy literate. And so I always see it as like this boot camp of like 2 to 4 weeks where I am just performing in front of really intelligent comedy audiences. And then what the problem is I'll often like come back to the States and then go and play that club in Boise, Idaho, and they are not 101 students, and they are a little too far behind, I think, the joke sometimes. But yeah, I mean, they just, you know, these people at Melbourne, the festival, they're seeing like dozens of shows from comics from all over the world. They've seen it, they've heard it all. And so it's just a really great opportunity to get better and perform smarter, is what I found.
Do you have a favorite idea that you're toying with at the moment? Is there something in particular that's like the, every time you get on stage, this is the one bit that you're like, oh, I love this. I love telling this. This is, you know, my thing that I'm most passionate about at the moment.
I think like I'm working on a lot of new stuff right now. Right now, the thing that I'm having the most fun talking about on stage is how I think space travel is such a waste of fucking time and money and energy. And what has space ever done for any of us at this point? Like we've been doing space for a long time now, and I haven't seen any great returns on it. You know, sometimes we'll get a picture back from Mars and it's like, okay, this looks like shit, first of all. And it's not making my life any better. Like there are some real pressing concerns on this fucking planet, and you're telling me you're just getting pictures of Mars? Like, fuck off. And so I go on a long tear about the many aspects of space travel that I, find to be wasteful and stupid. Because space travel is really about like math nerds trying to make math seem cool. Like they're always talking about like all of the like calculations they have to do on pen and paper sometimes, like back in when it was first starting. And I'm like, math isn't cool. It will never be cool. I don't care if you got a man into space because of math. Like you cannot get me to care about math or space. And like, yeah, so that is like, that's the tenor of a lot of the material.
Yeah, that's a fun idea. That's great.
It's taking a really strong stance on something that is very low stakes, is like definitely the theme, I think, for a lot of the new stand-up that I'm trying right now.
That's great. That's very exciting. Well, I can't wait to hopefully see you in Australia, but also for people to come and see you in Australia. The Melbourne Comedy Festival is such a great place, and part of the reason it is such a, you know, world-renowned festival is because it is able to form relationships with comedians like yourself who, like, you know, come over. I imagine the first time you ever came over, you did headliners, right? Like, was that what you did the first time? You know, so just a bunch of comedians on on a bill. Like, now you're one of the, you know, best comedians in the world. You've got this Netflix special, your career. Oh, yeah. I've heard you described, to be honest, as the modern day Lena Dunham. That's what I'm.
I don't know. I think that a lot of people could say that as a pejorative, too. So you have to be really careful about the intent if you ever hear someone describe me that way. But no, I am so excited. And the relationships that I've been able to form with comics from all over the world, like that's the other reason I keep coming back, is just like getting to hang with people like Fern Brady and Phil Wang and Rose Matafeo and like all of these people that like I've become really great friends with over the years because of this festival have been, it's just so special. And Zainab Johnson, who I'm splitting the bill with at Melbourne, is so funny and such an incredible comic. And her new stuff is killer. And so I think it's going to be a really, really fun night of comedy, just the two of us.
I'm really excited about it. Genuinely two of the funniest people working in the world at the moment. It's going to be must-see. Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Thank you so much for doing this today. I know we had a couple of technical issues, but I think it'll all be fine.
Yeah, it'll cut together great, I bet.
Yeah, I mean, you were great. You were great, and I need you to know this. You were great. Thank you.
Thank you.